is absolutely critical to a successful program. They need to be partners with you in the program and completely understand how that works. Lastly, it's no commissions. It's just that simple. With a trust, depending upon your state law, you typically are placing 100% of the consumer payment in the trust. Some states don't require 100% of the trust. For instance, in the Southeast, I can think of several states right now that require 70 to 80% trusting. And so a lot of firms will use the non-trusted portion or the 30 or 20% that don't trust, use that for the commissions. Okay. Here's the life cycle of a pre-need contract. The contract itself is sold. You've received the down payment or it's paid in full. Once you receive that contract and the money, you typically hand that off to someone in your office, whether it be a sales secretary, an administrator in your office, so on and so forth. From there, the administrator figures out how much money is required to be placed in trust, and they deposit that amount on behalf of the consumer. And then every month, the administrator will reconcile the trust. Now, trust reconciliation is almost like reconciling your personal check account, with the exception that on a monthly basis, you're having income, dividends, you'll have expenses in the trust, you may have capital gains, realized or unrealized, or even losses in the trust. Those have to be distributed to each client in the trust, and client is either the funeral home level or the pre-need contract level. So that'll get distributed on a monthly basis, and we'll walk you through that as well. And then lastly, the pre-need contract is withdrawn from the trust. Typically, the only way a pre-need contract comes out of the trust is if the pre-need contract itself fulfills, in other words, the individual, the beneficiary has died, or the purchaser is canceled, or the purchaser has actually defaulted on that pre-need contract. Okay, so to recap, pre-need contract is sold, funds are collected. Next, the pre-need contract and down payment are given to the administrator. Now, this is what we're going to talk about now, what the administrator does. Typically, again, the administrator can be an internal staff member if you manage your own trust, or it may be a state association that sponsors a trust. Some states, I think Ohio is one, the association itself has a master trust, and so you would probably send a copy of the pre-need contract and the payments directly to the association itself. Now, that's what my company does as well. We administer those trusts for individual funeral homes and cemeteries, or maybe a master trust that has numerous funeral homes and cemeteries in them. And we also administer trusts for banks and trust companies, as well as insurance companies offering pre-need trust offerings. So, in third-party pre-need marketers, one of our larger clients works in multiple states, and we help that client set up trust in those states and then provide all the record keeping for that client. Okay, so the administrator gets the money, gets the contract, records the contract, and tracks consumer payments or the accounts receivable on the contract, determines how much money to place into the trust for states not requiring 100% trusting, deposits the appropriate amount of the trust, and then allocates the earnings and expenses every month. All right, payments are then deposited in the trust and investment. Let's talk about that for a minute.
Now, this is Jim. The trustee takes over once the payments become into the trust, and for them to know what to do, they have to start out with what's called an investment policy statement. And this is a roadmap. It tells the trustee how the funeral home wants those monies invested. And it's important that you have that. If your trustee doesn't have one, they need one. It's really a requirement on their part, and it's a way to establish how those funds are going to be invested and what are the key objectives of that trust. Most of the time, individuals don't pay attention or set a true, clear objective, but this is crucial. And in these funds, there's really one major objective they want to do, and that's outpace inflation. When a pre-need contract is sold, you have certain costs. If it's fulfilled 10 years later, those costs have increased. That increased cost is inflation. You want your investments to outpace that inflation.
Jim and Bill, question from somebody. I know you're probably going to touch on this, but how do you develop that investment strategy so you're outpacing inflation?
We will touch on this a little bit more later also, but the key here is to have the right mix of investments to determine the goal, which we've said is to outpace inflation. That gives the trustee a target. Generally, that target is going to be at inflation after fees and expenses, so you're looking to get a return on average of 5 or 6%. They match the investments to do that. That leads to this. Here is a typical or sample investment policy statement. It's called a balanced approach. In this case, we have equities, stocks, IBM, Bank of America, whatever the investment manager has chosen, and we have fixed income bonds, which are either governments, treasuries, or corporate bonds, or so forth, and then cash. This gives them an idea. When you look further at this, this breaks down the equities. Equities would represent approximately 45%, and it would, again, it would be stocks, some you may be familiar with. Could be an ExxonMobil, could be a Microsoft, could be a Wells Fargo. These are intended to increase in value over time. You buy them at $100 a share. Hopefully when they're sold, they're worth $120 a share. Whatever. That is where you beat or keep up with inflation or exceed inflation is with the equity portion.
So, Jim, let me ask you a question, if you don't mind, for a second. What we're seeing here is a pie chart, and the pie chart is basically broken out into three segments. You have the equity segments, which is about 45% in this example. Fixed income is 52% of the investments, and then you have cash for about 3%. So what you're saying is you can take that equities in this slide, and you can further break those down into different market segments, and then break those market segments down into individual trusts or individual investments.
Correct.
Okay.
And here we've got two indicated, which would be large cap value, large cap growth. Those are techniques, a value strategy, a growth strategy. All trustees, investment managers have a style or a strategy that they're good at, that they implement, and that work for them. But yes, this is a very broad overview. You could get down into all the way to this, how they choose the individual equities.
So, and they call this a balanced approach. Why?
This is called balance because the fixed income and the equities essentially are the same amount. And the cash is there because that allows them to pay fees, expenses, and do distributions without having to sell something. Flip the coin, and now we're looking at the fixed income. Fixed income here represents 52% in our sample. And this is invested simply to pay interest. And it gives money coming in the form of cash flow from interest off of the bonds, whether they're governments, corporate, mortgage-backed, or whatever. There's some form of fixed income.
And so being a balanced approach like this, so you got equities on one side, fixed on the other, and it kind of gives you a little bit, from a risk standpoint, it balances the risk as well. Is that correct?
It does. It gives you the ability where equities may fluctuate more, the fixed income doesn't. If the value of equities are up, bonds are usually stable. If bonds go up, equities usually go down. So it is a blend that works well together. You mentioned risk, and as we go to the next slide, we look here at a measure of risk. This is from a trustee that I happen to know. And their portfolio, this is the equity side, the S&P 500 in the right-hand column, which has a 1, that is the risk of the market. The 1 highlighted now, which says 0.9, means that this portfolio has less volatility, and as far as risk is concerned, it will have less risk. This portfolio has a better dividend yield, and overall has a very competitive return to the S&P 500, which would be the benchmark.
With less risk overall.
With less risk overall on the equity side. Correct.
So to go back to Patty's question that she put forth to us just a second ago, you as a funeral director or a funeral homeowner or cemetery owner would go down, sit down with your bank at your local trust company. You would show them what your intended purpose for the trust is, and hopefully that trust, the intended purpose would be to outpace inflation.
Correct.
and maybe you sit down with the banker and talk about, or the investment manager, talk about a balanced portfolio. If you're not quite as adverse to risk, you may want to have more monies in the equity portion of the trust.
Bill, you bring up a great point, because the funeral home owner has a voice. They're not allowed to control the investments, but they have a voice, and part of it is how comfortable they are with the portfolio having risk. We've had clients that we've worked with which do not want very much risk. Their portfolio would have less in equities. We have one particular client that we worked with in the past that really was comfortable with risk and had a significantly higher equity position because they understood that investment and were comfortable with it. It's part of the relationship, having a good conversation with the trustee investment manager and understanding both sides of the equation.
So, kind of, let's just stay on the subject for just a second before we move forward. So the owner would go to a local bank or the trust company, sit down with the banker, the investment advisor, the trust advisor, whomever, and start to build the investment policy statement. The first step would be maybe how much risk you got, so whether you want a balanced portfolio or something a little more riskier and aggressive that have a higher weight of equities to maybe fixed income. And then from there, you would take whichever section you want to work with first, maybe the equity section, divided up into certain market segments like large cap growth or large cap value or international or something of that nature. You do the same thing on the fixed income side, what type of bonds and things you want on that side. And then you further break that down into the individual investments inside each one of those pieces. So for people in our industry, as a general rule, we're not money managers from that standpoint. And so that's why it's very helpful to have somebody that knows what your goals are in your trust. If your goals are to outpace inflation, you may have a little bit more conservative approach, but if your goal is to aggressively manage the assets in your trust, which brings a higher risk, and you tell your investment advisor that, they can help design an investment policy statement for your goals, correct?
That is correct. And Bill, it is exactly having that conversation, and a good trustee investment manager will help educate clients into what they're doing.
Okay. Patty, we hope that answered the question. If not, please jump back in and we'll try to hit it again.
No, I think okay. That's good, and we'll continue on. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, every trust has got expenses, and that's what we're going to talk about at this point. So not only does the trust have income, but expenses and gains are also recorded at the trust level each month by the trustee. We said a while ago when you reconcile the trust on a monthly basis, that the trust statement would come in basically and show you what those gains and expenses are. What's funny about that, and not everybody understands this, is that the pre-need contracts within the trust themselves don't own any individual investments. All the investments are owned at the trust level itself. The pre-need contract owns a pro rata value of the entire trust, and that concept is not usually a big deal until you start doing what we do, doing all the record keeping for those things. And it can be a little fun sometimes. But when a pre-need contract dies, the bottom line is you don't have to go out and sell 3 shares of Microsoft. That's done at the trust level, and then everything is distributed down to the contracts. All right, the administrator reconciles the trust, we've gone over this several times now, and allocates not only all the income and expenses, but any unrealized gains or losses on a pro rata basis to every client that's in the trust, and then from that client, they're pushed down, if you would, on a pro rata basis to every contract in the trust. And then at FSI, we actually put those revenues and expenses, we push them all the way down to the individual line item on that pre-need contract within the trust.
Bill, why do you push it down to the line item?
I'm glad you asked, Jim. Good straight guy. Here's what happens. This is usually not important on the funeral side, but it can be very important on the cemetery side of a pre-need contract. A lot of cemeteries take the position that once certain pieces of merchandise, such as a monument or a memorial, are paid in full in that contract, they'll go ahead and deliver that one line item off the contract. In other words, they'll literally put the monument or memorial on the ground. Once that's done, that merchandise is considered delivered. So we can then go into the trust for proper record keeping and withdraw the memorial and all of its associated earnings for specific to that memorial only, and give that back to the cemetery so they can fulfill it at that point.
Okay, market value. You know, we've used that term, and I want to make sure everyone's on the same page when we talk about market value. And at any point in time, as we sit here today, the assets in that trust can be valued, and it is what the value would be if all the assets were sold at that time. At the end of the day, the assets in a trust are valued based on what the close of the markets are, whether it's the New York Stock Exchange, NASDAQ, or wherever they're traded, because all the securities in a trust are valued and traded on those exchanges, and it's the pricing that you have. Now, never allow the trust or your account in the trust to be reported as something other than market value, because it doesn't give you a true picture of what's going on.
Trust withdrawals, typically what we said a while ago, the only time typically on a pre-need trust that funds come out of that pre-need trust is because of fulfillment of the actual pre-need contract, in other words, the death of the beneficiary, or the consumer has canceled the contract, or the consumer has defaulted the contract. Most trusts don't allow any withdrawals out of the trust, with the exception for these three things, obviously, which is the whole part of it. And market value part two. So here's a little bit more about that. Pre-need contracts, as Jim said, should always be withdrawn from the trust at market value. And we're going to show you some details in a few minutes as to why. But again, like Jim said, market value includes income, which is interest and dividends. It also includes expenses such as trustee fees, administration fees for what we do, investment manager fees, taxes. It also includes realized capital gains and losses, and unrealized capital gains and losses. So the next part, what we're going to be talking about, is avoiding the roadblocks, and we're going to show you why the market value is so important and why it should come out of that.
Right, and identifying these circumstances that can derail programs is important. Looking at measuring trust program performance, paying attention to what the providers are doing, and then realizing the mistakes that a trustee may make can cause you problems. We've all seen headlines where in the industry takes a hit because of mistakes or actions by a few bad individuals. One of the key things is, if you're in a master trust or you have a trust, ask questions, understand the process, get advice. Two key categories where issues arise are service providers that don't specialize in this industry, and there's not independence check and balances or transparency. Common roadblocks: guaranteed rates of return, a lack of market value reporting, unknown fees and charges, a weak management structure of the pre-need program, and absence of knowledgeable specialized providers. These are the key things that cause roadblocks.
Jim and Bill, may I interrupt you for 1 second? We do have a question. How often should you be talking with that advisor to make sure that everything is where it's supposed to be, weekly, monthly, quarterly?
My suggestion is that at a bare minimum twice a year, but I believe at least on a quarterly basis is probably good.
And to expand on that, one of the things, and we're going to touch on this in just a minute, it is extremely important that when you get your trust statement on a monthly basis, that you look at it. I can't tell you how many times I go into firms that are clients of ours, and we've got several years worth of monthly statements sitting over in the corner, never been looked at. You need to know what's going on in your trust. You need to know if the trusts are having positive rates of return or negative rates of return, and we're going to go into that now and show you exactly why that's so important. But every month, look at your trust statement. Work with your, or even sit down with your trustee, your investment advisor, like Jim said, twice a year. But it's very important that, you know, every quarter or every 6 months, Jim, that they look at what the returns of their trust are. And if the returns are not keeping up to snuff, then they really need to sit down and talk with the trustee about maybe how they can fix that. But you can't look at it on a monthly basis, and maybe you can explain why.
Right.
As far as the returns are concerned.
As far as returns, you know, having a year where returns aren't up to par may be acceptable. It's when you have a 3-year period that you really ought to start look, or 2 years even, say, this is where we want to be. You're not meeting the objectives we established in the investment policy statement. And following up on what Bill said, if you see something in your statement this month, call your trustee. Ask questions. That's what they're getting paid for. Do not be afraid to ask questions.
Even if you know the market has been down and you see maybe a loss in the current statement, pick up the phone and call them. That's what they're there for.
Yeah.
All right, so let's go back to the roadblocks and we'll come back and talk more about that question in just a second. Guaranteed rates of return. We highly recommend that if you're in a trust that has a guaranteed rate of return, that you seriously can reconsider and do something else. And we're going to show you why right here. Typically, how a trust that has a guaranteed rate of return in it, what happens is that whatever the investment, if the trust returns are greater than what the trust has guaranteed you, the excess funds go into a reserve account. The exact opposite of that's true. If the trust returns are less than what you've been guaranteed, any shortages come out of the reserve account. But there's a problem here. When you get into a down market like we had in 2008 and 2009, and Jim, even going back to 2002, there was a little bit of a market hiccup there.
Correct.
Now, overall, I don't want to scare anybody. Overall, your money is always, always pretty much safe over time in the markets than they are just about anywhere. It's going to give you the best rates of return. But if you put money in the market today and the market drops tomorrow, you're going to lose money. It's that simple. But if you put money in the market 3 years ago and the market drops tomorrow, you're still probably ahead of the game. But that's not what's always can happen with these guaranteed trust funds. Let me show you how that works. A few numbers here. In this example we've got in year one, this guaranteed trust, and these numbers are all fictitious. They're just here to show how the example works. If there's a guaranteed rate of return of 5% and you put a $5,000 contract in the trust, at the end of year one, that contract will be worth $5,250. However, if the actual trust returns were 6%, you didn't get the benefit of that because the fair market value of that contract was $5,300. But as I said earlier, if you're guaranteed 5% and the returns are actually better, then the difference will go into the reserve account, in this case, the $50. So let's go through it a little bit more. In year three in this example, we had a down market. The trust itself, the investments in the trust, had a 4% negative rate of return. Now, what's interesting here is the fair market value of this contract. In other words, if this money were yours and in a money market fund, or excuse me, a mutual fund, you would get back out the fair market value. But in this example, the contract is going to actually pay $5,788.13. Now, think about that for a minute. The fair market value of the investments are $5,342.40, but you're going to get $5,700 back plus. Now, that may seem great on the surface, but watch what happens as we continue to go through this thing. In year seven, the guaranteed contract value would be $7,035.50. But in this example, the fair market value is $5,602.29. The reality of it is, the number to the right of that circle is that $1,400 has got to come from somewhere. And think about that for just a second. The contract, if you sold all the assets in the trust right now, there would only be $5,600 in that trust. Yet somebody's going to pay you $7,035. Now you take that problem right there and you multiply that problem by tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands of pre-need contracts, and you'll know what happened to states like Illinois and or maybe even Wisconsin. Nobody was paying attention to what was happening, the fair market value versus the guaranteed value, and the reserve accounts got upside down, and they're still paying for that today. So let's walk through that just a little bit more, show you a little bit more how that works. Pre-need contracts, again, should always be withdrawn at market value, and market value is nothing more than the cash value of that trust if everything inside that trust was sold at a given point in time. So keep that in mind. All right, lack of market value is one of the common roadblocks we're speaking of. The original contract amount in this example is $5,000, and it's got interest and dividends worth 101, and capital gains, and expenses of a negative $55.98 for a grand total or a net amount of $201.34, or it has increased in value by 4.03%. We're going to compare that to market value. So you now have the same pre-need contract of $5,000. Even with market value accounting, you still have the same income, which is interest, dividends, and realized capital gains. The difference with market value accounting is that you have, and you're getting the benefit of, unrealized capital gains. Now, Jim, you want to explain real quick like what an unrealized capital gain is?
Basically, realized capital gains occur when an investment is sold. Unrealized gains are those gains that exist in the investment prior to the sale. So if you bought it at $100, it's worth $120, you've got a $20 unrealized gain.
But if you bought it at $100 and you sold it at $120, you have a $20 realized gain.
Correct.
Okay. So in this example, we've got unrealized capital gains of $79.35. We had the same amount of expenses, but look what's happening. In this example, the market value is 5.61% or $280.69. The difference being you're getting the benefit of unrealized capital gains at the trust level. Now, stick with me for just a second. Watch what happens here. Same contract for $5,000, but this time you have a market value loss or an unrealized capital loss. You bought that stock for $100. It is depreciated, or in other words, it has gone down in value when the contract fulfilled, and so you're getting hit with that. But if you'll look at the example, you're still got $121.99 to the good, or 2.44% to the good, versus the other side, which is $5,200. Now, maybe I can drive that home a little bit better here for you in just a second. What's happening is on the cost basis side, if the administrator is not providing you market value of that pre-need contract, or if you're getting paid out of a guaranteed trust fund, which is exactly what happened, I think, in Wisconsin, Jim. I'm not 100% sure, but Wisconsin or Illinois, one of the two, had that problem.
Hey, I'm not sure which one is.
But I know in Wisconsin, well, last I heard anyway, in Wisconsin, is that funeral homes and cemeteries who use that trust with getting back out 40 cents on the dollar. In other words, in this example right here, you got, let me see if I can make this work. How do you make that work, Heather? All right, here it is. So, in other words, your original $5,000 contract, getting 40 cents on the dollar, is now worth only $2,000. My point is this. On the left side, you see the cost basis of $5,200, or maybe it's a guaranteed trust that has a guaranteed rate of return, and the return you get is better than the market value. Very seldom is that going to happen. But if it does happen, you really need to question what's going on in that trust, how the accounting works. The last thing you want to see happen is something bad happens in the market, something bad happens to the trust, nobody's paying attention, and the next thing you know, you're getting 40 cents on the dollar for the monies your consumers put in that trust, and now you've got to fulfill that pre-need contract. Okay.
Gentlemen, can I interrupt you for 1 second? Have a question. Don't know if this is the right time to ask, but it is. What is the standard for the number of stocks bought and sold in a given period of time?
You know, there's not really a standard. However, if most trustees purchase and sell and keep on an annual basis, where capital gains or losses are less than 10 or 15% of the total trust. So you don't have a constant buying and selling. If you see in a three-month period buys and sales that are over 100 trades, I would start beginning to have questions. Most good investment managers that I am aware of, I'm more qualified, that I am aware of, do not have significant trades in their portfolios all the time, and they pay attention to the capital gains and losses. Now, getting back to unknown expenses and fees, which is our next topic here. Fees are based on market value, and the larger the trust, the lower the fee. It's important that you know what your fee is and how that fee is calculated. Additionally, you're going to have fees for administration and record keeping. You need to have an idea of what those are and realize, as Bill mentioned earlier, that there are fees and expenses in addition, capital gains taxes, tax returns, and so forth.
Jim, let me interrupt you for just a second. I jumped several slides ahead for you because we're running almost behind a little bit for some additional Q&A. So I got to here. And so what this shows here is a typical return for a pre-need trust. Maybe you can explain what's going on here. Then we're showing the net with the fees in it in just a second.
Here's trust returns. And this is a example of what I like to see when you're getting performance numbers. It gives you not only the return for the trust over different time frames, it gives you two benchmarks. And those benchmarks compare to the investment policy statement, whether it's a balanced trust or not, and you get to see how they're doing in different time frames.
If you recall earlier in the presentation, we talked about one of the things that you can do is measure these trusts, and that's what you're getting at here then, right?
Exactly. It's clear here, if your objective is to beat inflation, that you're doing that because we know inflation is somewhere in the neighborhood of 2-2.5%. These returns on average are above 6%, so even after fees and expenses, we're exceeding inflation and the trusts are keeping up and they're meeting the objective. And in this case, the trust net return is going to be that return minus whatever the total fees are, and they're going to be in a range. So if you've got a 7.2 return, you're going to have between a 4.9 and a 6.2 return. Understand that if the fees are higher, you may not keep up with inflation. And it's the reason master trusts work, because the volume allows them to have reduced fees.
Yeah, a master trust may have literally hundreds of funeral homes or cemeteries inside the master trust, and they all share in the overhead expense of the trust, keeping that expense down at the firm level. And there's enough assets in that trust to actively manage, in other words, invest those assets for a greater possibility of return, right?
Correct. It's easier to invest $10 million than it is $250,000.
Right.
But a key point I've got to make here is know what the fees are and know how they're calculated.
Because, Jim, I jumped a few frames ahead of you, why don't you just go through these fees real quick and kind of explain them.
Trustee investment management fees are based on market value. If the trust is $1 million, 35 basis points is going to be $3,500. If it's 80, it's going to be comparable. Now, it's going to be $800. I can't do the math in my head. The administration fees, very similar. What you may not see is if they have mutual funds, they have internal fees. There may be transaction fees that aren't in here. Those are the ones that you need to realize.
Thank you. Okay. I know we had to go through that piece quickly, and I'm sorry that we did that, but let me go through a few more roadblocks that you guys should be aware of. Just like in any good business, you need to have segregation of duties. And operating a trust is no different. In trust, you typically have a trustee, an investment manager. You have the death care firm itself. You typically have an independent investment reporter. And Jim, you want to explain what that does real quick?
Yes. Most trustees and many investment managers have a third party that their sole function is to calculate investment returns. They're independent, and they calculate the returns on the trust without any influence from the people managing the trust.
In other words, the investment managers themselves.
Correct.
So what that means basically is you don't have the fox in the hen house. You don't have the investment manager out there telling you you've got a 6% return. You've got an independent party out there showing you exactly what the investment manager is doing. That way the investment manager is not reporting their own returns.
Correct. And they also provide the benchmark numbers. And their calculations are based on acceptable industry standards for that, not any other method.
The next one you have is going to be the administrator or the record keeper. So if you look at those four up there on the board right now, you get the trustee or the investment manager, which can be one of the same or separate.
Correct.
you got the death care firm itself, and you got the independent investment reporter, and then the administrator or record keeper. Any one of those four or five that you see up there, if there's an issue, one of them will probably spot it and report it to you. Okay, weak management structures. Trustee investment managers is number one, they're an investment policy statement. If there is, then you need to review that investment policy statement, and if you don't understand it, do what Jim suggested a while ago. Go sit down with your trustee or an investment manager at least twice a year. Find out what the investment policy statement says if you don't understand it. Ask a trustee or investment manager to show how the actual performance of the trust returns are against certain indices. Right, Jim?
Correct. And this investment policy statement should be updated annually.
Every year?
Every year.
Okay. So who is actually reviewing the actual performance of the ISP or the investment IPS, rather, investment policy statement?
And that's the responsibility of the client. They should get that information from the independent service. Now, the trustee is going to provide it, but they're using the independent service. And the trustee pays for that, by the way.
Well,
and then that should be reviewed by you and reviewed with the trustee or investment manager to confirm what's there. And here's an item I want to mention at this slide. Bernie Madoff, if they had an independent investment calculation firm doing this, he couldn't have done what he did.
And that's an excellent point. Typically, a trustee or an investment manager does not have specialized experience and knowledge in the death care industry. So that's why it's so important that you, as the manager or the owner of the firm, go sit down with the trustee, and between the two of them, you've got to educate them on what your needs are in the trust, how the trusts operate, what your expectations are, which should be as a bare minimum to outpace inflation, and then they'll help you get there. So you've got to educate them as much as they're going to educate you on this endeavor.
And if you have problems, find someone who does have information and get work with them to get what they need.
The biggest problem we see, and I mentioned it earlier, is, believe it or not, us. Are we actively engaged? Are we knowledgeable? Do we know what's going on with our trust? Do we actually open the trust statement every month and look at it and question it if there's something that we don't understand or we don't see in those trusts? You need to review the investment policy statement with the trustee, like Jim said, at least every year, hopefully even more so than that. And then equally important, you need to clean up any contract errors. And what's typical is that maybe somebody input the contract wrong into the computer system, or that Susie Q made a $100 payment on her contract and it was credited to another contract. So anytime there are errors found, you need to be very, very aware of that and fix those errors as soon as possible. And then you have the administrator record keeper, which is what FSI does. We do everything above that line or assist you with doing those things and show you how those things are done as well. So you've got, not only do you have a good structure here on what not to do here, but you can look at each individual person or each individual bullet point up here and know that each one of them plays a part. And if you do it properly and you segregate the duties among everybody, you'll have a much stronger performance of those trusts, and something that you can, Jim, I hope, have great returns on. And when the time comes to fulfill one of those contracts, it has actually outperformed from an inflationary standpoint, at the very least. It's kept up with the inflation and provides the firm more money back than what was put in there at that price.
And you're correct. It also does one thing, and it offers transparency. Everything is... Everyone has a function, and it's kind of like bundled cable TV, telephone, and internet, and all these things. It's hard to find out what everything is done when that occurs. Having different parties, they may identify things for you also. That transparency is very important.
All right, pathways to success. The funeral home has got to work with the trustee to develop the IPS, submits pre-need contracts and consumer payments on time to the trust or the administrator. Very important. Reviews and monthly account statements every single month. If nothing else, just open them up and look at them. See if you got more money in it than you did the month before. If not, question it. The trustee works with the funeral home to develop that investment policy statement, oversees the investment manager, and keeps updated on industry regulatory changes, which is extremely important.
And if they're not keeping up with the industry regulatory changes, you need to find a different trustee, because if they make a mistake, they're going to cost you money. investment manager, they're going to be investing those funds. They're going to be following that roadmap that you developed. Additionally, they're going to have oversight by the trustee and by you to see what's going on. Finally, you're going to have that independent investment reporter that's providing the calculations so you can see what the performance actually is.
The administrative record keeper, again, monthly reconciliation, the trust statements, and reporting using nothing but market value. Let me throw this out at you real quick. If you don't understand the health of your trust, if you're in a master trust from the state association or someone else, it's a very simple question you can go ask somebody in charge of that trust. Go in and ask them this question: how much money was put into the trust, and tell me what the current market value is. If the current market value is less than the money placed into the trust, there may be an issue and you need to dig further. It's a very simple question to ask somebody, and they should be able to give you that information very easily. Okay, administrative record keeper determines trust liability for each consumer payment, allocates earnings and expenses monthly, and provides most of the regulatory reporting. What we do at FSI is we're actually the agent for the funeral firm for money that's going into the trust, and we're the agent for the trustee for money that's coming out of the trust. We perform most of the functions that the trustee is normally charged with performing in your state pre-need statutes, because the trustees just don't have the ability to do that. So we step in as their agent, making sure that when a contract is fulfilled, that we, in fact, on behalf of the trustee, have a copy of the certified death certificate in hand, and then we release the money on behalf of the trustee back to you, the funeral home. Outside of that, we had to run through the last couple pieces of it to get quick to kind of catch up, and we apologize for that. And so, Ms. Patty, if we've got any questions out there that we can cover, we'd be glad to do it at this time.
We absolutely do. One of the first is, I know you talked about the performance of your trust, but how do you know how your trust is performing? What is the best way for an owner manager to really understand how their trust is performing? Is it opening that monthly statement? And
Patty, that's an excellent question. It is at least, and I recommend a quarterly, sitting down with the trustee, looking at the investment performance compared to indices and checking that market value and seeing how it's comparing to what you want it to do. If you remember the bar chart we had where it talked about trust returns, you should get something similar from your trustee investment manager that reflects this over a 1, 3, 5 year period, perhaps even longer. And you know, if over 3 to 5 years that number's not beating inflation, you need to be making some changes.
Jim, let me expand on that just a minute. It is very important. And we went through the investment policy statement piece. I know it's really detailed, and it's very important. I wish we could spend more time on it. But once you build the investment policy itself, you may have that mixture that we showed you in the pie chart that's 45% equities and maybe 53% fixed income investments, 2 or 3% in cash, something like that for the whole deal. You need to be able to look at that, and your investment advisor can do this. If you have a very aggressive type of management style for those investments, you need to compare it against a very aggressive index. You don't want to compare something that's very aggressive that you have against a very meek or mild-mannered or conservative investment index. You want to make sure you're comparing apples and apples. So if the index is similar to your investment strategy, now you can look at them side by side to see how your trust returns are doing. If, in fact, the index itself is down and you're down and you're taking on more risk or don't have the returns you want, maybe you need to conserve a little bit, or get more conservative, have maybe less equities and more money in fixed income, or the exact opposite depending upon how the market's going. And the important part is that you don't have to be an investment advisor to know all this. That's what you pay your trustees for. That's what you pay your investment managers for, or your administrators like FSI can help sit down with you and do those things as well and point you in the right direction.
And it's exactly part of the communication process. If you're not visiting with your trustee at least quarterly and having conversations, they're not going to understand where you're coming from, and you won't be able to learn from what they're trying to say. Now, sometimes they talk different languages. I understand that. But developing that relationship is crucial. And I want to add one item here. You know, you should be able to get from your record keeper how much money was deposited into trust, that total. And you can compare that to the market value and see if your trust is performing well or not, too. Hey, good question.
And this also leads to another question is, how can you make sure as a funeral home owner or manager that the information about your trust is accurate? It says so on a piece of paper, but how do you know that it's really accurate?
Well, that is a phenomenal question. First of all, if you're using a reputable trust company or reputable bank, those people go through audits like you wouldn't believe. Whether it's state chartered or federally chartered, you can pretty much believe whatever the bank tells you. Now, if you're getting your statement from maybe a state association or even a company like FSI, let's talk about FSI for just a second. We administer master trusts that have literally hundreds of funeral homes and cemeteries inside of a single trust. So how do you know our statements are valid? Every single year, this company, FSI, goes through what's called an SSAE 16 Type 2 compliance audit. That's the most boring thing in the world, but it comes from the Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002. If y'all remember when Enron and two or three more of those large companies all went belly up, Congress stepped in and required certain financial reporting. This company, every year, goes through an external audit by auditors who come in, and they verify everything we do. And they pull historical financial statements that we have produced for different firms and different trusts, and they go through those with a very fine-tooth comb, even to the point of going through our computer code to ensure that we're distributing income and expenses on a pro rata basis appropriately. So every one of our clients has access to that SSAE 16 Type 2 audit every year. And that's SSAE 16 Type 2. And so maybe you should ask if it's your trust company or bank's going to be there. They're going to have that audit. But if it's not a trust company or a bank, if it's a administrator like FSI who's providing those monthly statements, you need to go find out how they get audited and how often and what the audit results are.
And a key item here, and Bill mentioned it, make sure you're doing business with good-sized, reputable businesses that have been in business a long time. You know, if you've got your brother-in-law who just started financial management managing your trust, good luck. You know, having firms that have experience in the industry, I believe, is very important. If they don't understand the industry, it's easy to make mistakes.
This might lead into another question we have, and we really only have time for a couple more, so we'll get through these quickly. Does the level of fees give an indication to the quality of the administrator or the plan? Like, do you pay the Rolls-Royce price and not the Hyundai price?
Yeah, you know, that's one of the – I love getting this question. I remember what my grandfather used to tell me years ago when he was in the road construction business. He used to tell me that, you know, his fees were his fees, and his competitor down the street knew what quality and value he provided for his fee structure. And I imagine, like a lot of the funeral homes out there, if you provide the best service in your community, you probably have a premium price. We do the same thing. The bottom line is that you can pick and choose the services you want, and it can be very inexpensive or very expensive if you want us to do everything. But that doesn't necessarily mean just because one company is more expensive than another, they're necessarily better than another. You really need to look at the company, the reputation of that company, look at the services they provide, look at the audits they've been through over time and see what the audit results are. Look at the reporting those companies provide. Do they give you everything that you need from your state statute standpoint? In other words, if your statute in your state says you've got to have X reports X number of times a year, can they provide those reports to you? We literally go into a new state, we work with the state auditors in that state and design trust audit trails exactly the way the auditor wants them designed. The goal is when a auditor walks into an FSI client firm, they know what they're going to see because they've seen it at maybe two or three other firms in that local area, and they help design the audit. So those things aren't cheap. They cost money. We just went through a brand new computer upgrade. We're over $2 million just in the programming that we provide, but there's nobody in the country who has a system that's as good and flexible as ours is, and is easy to use from a web standpoint. You can access your account 24/7 via the internet, pull up an actual copy of the scanned image of the copy of the pre-need contract, see what was paid on that pre-need contract, how much of that money was trusted, what the current value is, and literally click a button and say, click, I have fulfilled this pre-need contract, and have the money sitting in your account typically before 10 a.m. the next business day. And those things are not inexpensive to build, but for the convenience and for what our clients demand and the world that we live in today, information at their fingertips and the movement of money in a very rapid manner to get back in their accounts so they can move forward and pay their bills are extremely important. I don't want you to think that we're extremely expensive. We're not. We're very competitive with our rates and our competitors, of which there may be, what, Jim, 5 or 6 or 8 of us out there across the entire country.
Correct.
We're all pretty competitive from that standpoint, but I wouldn't say we're real competitive from the services that we offer. I think some are much stronger than others.
Yeah, this question ties to value.
Tie back to the trustee and investment manager
and,
as well.
You know, for a trustee or investment manager, you're going to get a value for what you pay for. If they're giving you a very discounted price, it's going to be hard for them to give you the service and what you need because it costs quite a bit to have those resources available. I know that a former client of mine when I worked with SunTrust Bank has gone to a new trustee, and word on the street is what they're paying for a fee. And the comment is, well, I don't know how they can do it for that fee because they're not making a profit. You know, they're not going to get the service out of that trustee. I just don't see how that can happen. So you see these things, you're going to get what you pay for. And if you work with reputable people, they're going to get paid a reasonable fee. And that's the key. You're getting value for it. Pay attention to it. It should fall within, you know, if you talk to 2 or 3 providers, you're going to see that the fees are going to be within a fairly reasonable range.
Very good. And we have time for one more question, which love to hear your input on this. As a percentage, how many funeral homes offer inflation-proof contracts? And do you see that this trend increasing or decreasing?
That's a phenomenal question. This is Bill. It just so happens we're starting to see non-guaranteed pre-need contracts on the rise. It's just starting to happen in certain areas of the country. Some states are way ahead of others and have had the ability to do that for years. We just submitted our first contracts within the state of Florida that has the ability to guarantee or not guarantee individual line items in those pre-need contracts. And so the statutes have never addressed whether all contracts have to be guaranteed within the state of Florida or not. But everybody assumed that they were. We're seeing a big push now to go to non-guaranteed contracts. And we're also seeing some people who've gotten very creative out there, and they may charge an extra fee, which is perfectly legal, to guarantee that pre-need contract for a specific period of time. In other words, your current fees may be $6,000. You pay 10%, we'll guarantee the contract for 5 years. If you pay 15%, we'll guarantee it for 10 years. You pay 20%, we'll guarantee it for life, something of that nature. And all these different options are now starting to come up. It's pretty unique how it's working. You just got to be careful that you disclose those fees. They're perfectly legal, but you've got to disclose those on your general price list if you're going to charge those pre-need type fees. We're seeing it quite a bit and getting more and more so every year. The only states that are going to have issues are the ones that currently say that you have to guarantee a pre-need contract. The only way around that in that state is going to be change the laws.
Yeah, Michigan has done a good job. I'm familiar with them and work with clients in Michigan, and they have specific laws toward non-guaranteed contracts. Majority is still, as Bill mentioned, where contracts are guaranteed, but you're seeing more and more where non-guaranteed contracts are coming around.
Patty?
Hi, gentlemen. I think it looks like we've run out of time. So on behalf of Kate Spoilston, I'd like to thank Bill and Jim. Their contact information is on the screen in front of you right now. It will also be in the follow-up email that we send out. So if you have any more questions, please, I'm sure they would love to hear from you. So Bill and Jim, thank you very much. Special thanks to FSI and Infinity Management, and also to our attendees who took the time out of their otherwise busy days to get some great information. And I am sure that Bill and Jim, maybe last words on the one thing that these attendees can go home and do today or first thing tomorrow morning to change the way they're doing business. Any thoughts?
Jim?
Go look at your statements.
Go look at your statements. Absolutely. I think that's the best advice in the world. Thanks, Patty.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you, and have a great day now, everyone. Bye-bye.